want to introduce to you our speaker, Amy Taylor, who's there's a lot of big words there in that paragraph on who she is. What she is an economist, and with Pembina Institute, been with them for 7 years, and her specialty is tax, royalties, and subsidies, particularly as it relates to energy. And she's talking on the oil sands, the tar sands. So let's welcome Amy Taylor.
Thank you, everyone. How's the sound? Everyone can hear me clearly? Great. Okay, so I'll just jump right in and give you a quick overview of what I'm going to be chatting about for about half an hour here until we can dive into lunch. A quick overview of the Pembina Institute for those of you that aren't familiar with our organization, some background on the oil sands, talk to you about Pembina's vision for the oil sands specifically as it relates to oil sands. To royalties, which will be the main topic of conversation today. Talk to you about the current royalty regime for oil sands and then where that regime has put us 10 years after it's been implemented, and then try and build a case for updating that royalty regime as part of the review that's taking place right now in the province. Whoops. I went past the one on the Pembina Institute, but I'll tell you about it anyways. We're a national environmental organization. We focus on energy-related issues. We've got about 55 staff across the country, offices in Toronto, Ottawa, Drayton Valley, Edmonton, Calgary, Canmore, and Vancouver. And we seek to advance solutions related to sustainable energy. So some background on the oil sands. We're talking about quite a significant resource here, covering about one quarter of the province of Alberta. It's the second largest oil deposit in the world, second only in size to Saudi Arabia. It encompasses 140,800 square kilometers of northeastern Alberta, as you can see in the map there, and it's about 23% of the province in terms of surface area. So clearly, given a resource of that magnitude, we're talking about significant production, oil production. Currently about one-third of all oil produced in the nation. Expected recoverable bitumen, which is the product from oil sands, is 174 billion barrels using current technology, and ultimately 315 billion barrels in the long run as technologies are further developed. It's expected that oil from the oil sands will make up about 85% of oil production in Alberta by the year 2015. So clearly a resource of significant value. So the Pembina Institute, getting into the royalties further and our position on it, we have a vision for the development of the oil sands as it relates to royalties, and that is that the oil sand development occurs at a pace and scale that optimizes financial benefit to the owners of the resource. So what this means is a fair royalty regime that ensures Albertan receive sufficient value for the development of the oil sands resource. And the reason that this is important is that it's the people that own the resource. Albertans own this resource. The Department of Energy, the Government of Alberta, manages that resource on our behalf. And in doing so, they allow companies to undertake developments. These companies incur costs and receive revenue when they develop and sell that resource. And then the government has a responsibility to transfer some of that revenue that they've earned back to Albertans, back to the owners of that resource. And so they do that mainly through royalties and also through lease sales. At the end of the day, the objective in that revenue transfer from companies back to Albertans via the government is to establish a royalty regime in which a win-win is achieved, in which companies retain a fair return on the investment that they've incurred in developing this resource, and that the balance of that value of resource is transferred back to Albertans. So that's the ultimate objective, to get to that win-win. Before describing the regime as it stands now, it's useful to just consider how it came to be. In 1995, the National Task Force on Oil Sands Strategies was formed. And this task force was charged with the task of making recommendations on the tax and royalty treatments of the oil sands. And the objective that was put before them was to provide a recommendation that would ensure fiscal policy certainty, that would remove or alleviate some of the barriers related to the high capital costs that were required to develop this resource, and to spur production. Up until that point, the royalties had been decided on a one-off basis with each company as they're undertaking a project. So the idea was to come up with a generic regime that would apply to all projects that would spur capital investment and increase production. The ultimate goal being to achieve 1 million barrels of oil a day from the oil sands by the year 2020. So that was 1995. The result of the task force was the Oil Sands Royalty Regulation 1997. And this regulation specifies the regime as it stands today, and that includes a minimum 1% royalty on gross revenue. So as soon as a company is earning revenue selling the product, they pay 1% of that to the government. And then once they've recovered their costs as well as return investment, or in other words, once they're earning profits, that royalty jumps to 25% of net revenue or 25% of profits. And this royalty rate applies to new projects and project expansions. So they set out to develop a regime that would spur capital investments and increase production. The oil sands royalty regulation was the result, and how did it do? Well, quite successful if your measure is capital investment and production. This regulation came into effect in 1997. Between 1997 and 2005, capital investments in the oil sands increased by over 300%. Production increased by over 88%. Oil sands production went from constituting 37% of the oil production in the province in 97 to 63% of the production in 2005. So by all accounts, a successful regime in terms of overcoming some of those barriers related to capital investment and spurring production. There's the trend in capital production, or capital investments, from $1.4 billion in 96 to $8.7 billion in 05, an increase of 521%. There's the trend in production, from 162 million barrels of oil in 96 to 361 million barrels of oil in 05. They reached their goal of 1 million barrels of oil a day in 2004. Their goal had been set to achieve in 2020, so obviously well ahead of schedule. At the same time that we've seen these massive increases in capital investment and production, the price of bitumen, the product from the oil sand, has increased quite significantly, 185% between 97 and 05. At the same time, technological improvements in the oil sands have occurred. So what we see today is essentially a new economic reality in the province relative to 1997 when this regime was put in place. We've seen massive increases in the price of oil. We've seen significant inputs of capital investment, and production has increased. Yet the royalty rate has stayed the same despite those changes. So what do we have as a result? Well, between 96 and 05, while production increased 123%, the royalties only increased 51%. So what this means is that we're getting less per barrel of oil today than we were then. And this is occurring at the same time that we're seeing record profits for companies. So instead of that win-win that we were seeking in through our royalty regime, where companies retain a fair return on their investment and a lot of the revenue is transferred back to Albertans as owners, we see this as a win-lose, where the emphasis is on leaving profits with companies and not transferring enough revenue back to Albertans. And here you can see the contribution of the oil sands from both a royalties and a production perspective. So the royalties is the black bars, which you can see trends like this, and the gray bars are production, which you can see trend upwards. So as royalties are making a greater contribution from a production perspective, they're making a declining contribution from a royalties perspective. Oh, I've lost my mouse. Oh, there we go. So here we show the revenue per barrel of oil. You can see in 1996, before the royalty regulation came into effect, it was $3.39. In 2005, it was $2.29, so that's a a decline of 32% with some fluctuations over the course of that time period. The bottom row there shows the royalties per barrel taking into account revenue from lease sales, which is another important way that the government obtains revenue from the development of this resource. That's when they grant the rights to a company to undertake the development. The company has to pay to obtain those rights. So you can see, even taking that source of revenue into account, there is still a decline in the revenue per barrel over that time period. And here we show the trend graphically over that same time period. And you can see the strong correlation with the price of oil, which is the line on the graph. But you see in recent years, despite quite a significant increase in the price, the royalty revenues are coming in, but still relatively low to where we were previous. So why this low return? Well, the low royalty rate is limiting revenue capture. The 25% net royalty is quite low relative to even that which is applied to conventional oil and natural gas or in some other regions, which I'll touch on in a couple of slides. Project expansions also limit the royalty revenue because a company could be paying the 1% royalty and just about to be earning a profit, but if they undergo an expansion and incur a whole bunch of new costs, then they stay longer at that 1% because it eats into their profits, which means they don't jump up to that higher royalty. And then another major factor is cost overruns. We're seeing easily 300% cost overruns in oil sands project, and that means that we stay longer at that 1% royalty. And I'll just elaborate on that a bit further in my next slide. So here's two scenarios. One in which cost overruns is taking place, one in which it isn't. Otherwise, these are two oil sands projects that are identical in nature. So we'll start with the no cost overruns, the box on your right-hand side. Assume that there's 100 barrels of oil that's going to come out of this project. And without cost overruns, 10 of those barrels, or 10%, come out at the 1% royalty. Company starts earning a profit. We jump to the 25%. So we get the 25% or the higher royalty for 90 barrels of 100. Not bad. Now look at the cost overrun scenario and assume 300% cost overruns. In this case, instead of 10 barrels of oil coming out at the 1%, we have three times as many. Or we have 30% or 30 barrels coming out at the 1%, which only leaves 70 instead of 90 for that higher royalty. So at the end of the day, what this means is that Albertans wait longer to go from the 1% to the 25%. And then once at that 25%, there's actually less production available to take place, so we get the 25% for less total production. So that's how the cost overruns are costing Albertans. Just a bit of comparison to give you a sense of how this regime compares to that which is applied to conventional oil and natural gas in the province. A bit of a tricky comparison because conventional oil and natural gas, their royalties are levied on gross revenue instead of net, so they're not necessarily directly tied to profits. But because the oil sands royalty takes into account those costs and is on profits, we would expect that it would be at least as high as the high end of the gross royalties, which don't have that element of taking it cost into consideration. But in fact, what we see is the high end of the natural gas royalty goes up to 35%, and that for conventional oil goes up to 40%. So that 25% is lower than both of those. And we're often compared to Norway as another region highly dependent on oil and gas. And in Norway, there's a 50% tax on profit, so twice what we're getting from our oil sands here in Alberta. So what does this mean in terms of the budget, the provincial budget, which came out within a month? And they're now predicting declining resource revenues within that budget. And there's a few things playing in there. They are predicting declines in the price of oil and declines in production. But a major contributor is this increased reliance on oil sands, which gets us a lower return relative to our other resources. And so there I've showed you the predictions for oil sands revenue for 07, 08, and 09, and you can see that in 09, these are millions, by the way, the revenue is lower than it is now. And in fact, there's a prediction, government's prediction, that in 2020, we'll be obtaining the same amount of revenue from oil sands as we are today, despite the fact that production over that time period is expected to triple. So a tripling in production, yet no more increase in revenue from the oil sands royalty. A quick note on tax treatment when it comes to the oil sands. The oil sands receives what's called the 100% Accelerated Capital Cost Allowance, or the ACCA, which essentially means that they're able to write off all of their costs before they pay any income tax. So they have to be earning a profit before they pay any income tax. For comparison, natural gas and conventional oil are able to write 25% of their capital expenditures off. So this is clearly quite a significant tax break that the oil sands receives, even compared to conventional oil and natural gas. And the Commissioner of the Environment and Sustainable Development, in fact, has described it as a significant tax concession, which creates an incentive to keep investing to avoid paying taxes. Now, the federal budget, which was released on March 19th, announced the phase-out of this subsidy. By 2015, it'll be gone from the as far as the federal government is concerned, and the provincial government has added it to part of the review that's currently taking place of royalties and taxes related to oil sands, oil, and conventional gas. So we'll see where they land in terms of keeping or removing the significant tax concession which the federal government has committed to phasing out. So our perspective is that given the fact that prices have increased significantly, the regime was designed to spur capital investment and increase production, and it has indeed accomplished those objectives, that it is time now to review and reform, update this royalty regime, which we consider to be outdated. It can no longer be justified on the basis of needing to spur capital investment and production. So the objective then should be to ensure the maximum value for the owners of the resource and achieve a win-win for companies and for citizens. That's where we want to get to in terms of the reform. Support for such a review is growing. The former Premier of Alberta, Peter Lougheed, has called for such a review. In fact, polling results indicate that 84% of Albertans support a review of the oil sands royalty. And I've included a quote there from Peter Lougheed from July 06. And he says, "The provincial royalty scheme cheats Albertans. Albertans own the resource, and they should get more faster." So the Pembina Institute has pulled together a blueprint, what we're calling a blueprint for royalty reform, which basically recommended to the government a process for reviewing and reforming the oil sands royalty regimes. And because this is quite a complex topic, we recommended four different avenues be taken. One is to pull together an expert panel and have that panel review and compare with other regions. Really do an in-depth investigation into the royalty regime and how it could be changed. To have an option of broad public input. Whoa. I'll just back up there. To have some option for broad public input, whether that be through hearings or, you could phone in or you could fax or submit something online, something of that nature, that there be some kind of a youth component, because the development of this resource obviously has significant implications for future generations and the youth of today, so that there be some kind of component that involves them and gets their perspective on the development of this resource and the royalties associated with it. And that there be something like a citizens' assembly. And what we mean by that is that the government would choose at random Albertans from across the province, and they would really empower them to obtain the information that they need in order to make an informed comment or recommendation on the royalties. So those individuals would be able to speak with experts. They'd be able to commission research. They would have the information put before them that they need to essentially become, experts in quite a short period of time on this topic. It is a complicated topic. It's very difficult for an average hardworking person to get up the learning curve on their own and to be able to make an informed comment on the royalty. So we suggested that be the fourth component, with the overlying theme be put citizens first. It's their resource, and we need to hear from them on what happens with the royalties, because if we don't get it right when we review this, we're going to be back where we are. There's going to be more uncertainty in the oil sands sector. And so it's important that we get it right, and it's important that it comes from citizens as the owners of the resource. So there is a consultation process underway right now. It has been launched in the province by our new premier. It does involve an expert panel, which is six individuals that have been chosen to participate. There is broad opportunity for broad public and stakeholder input, both through hearings, which are being held in five cities in about 3 days in each of those cities over the course of the next few months. You're able to make a 5 to 10 minute presentation. You can also submit comments either by telephone, fax, or online. There is no youth component or citizens' assembly, so this is how it differs. Could you get Paige up on that, on my computer? Do you know how? For some reason, my right-hand side. Yeah, perfect. So if you're interested in participating in that review, all of the information you need to do so is available at albertaroyaltyreview.ca. So that's the government's process for reviewing. The cities that they're hitting are, they've already done Grand Prairie. They're off to Edmonton, then Calgary, then Fort McMurray, and then Medicine Hat. So in terms of the Pembina Institute's participation in that, in the consultation that's currently underway, we will be and are in the process of drafting a recommendation, which we will be presenting in Calgary to the expert panel. Our objective will be to come up with different scenarios for ways that the royalty regime could be reformed to get a better return for Albertans. And to avoid a flight of capital, we'll be recommending that any changes are applied to new projects immediately and then phased in gradually for existing projects. So we'll be starting from the premise of what is it that we have now, and that is that right now we leave about 53% of profits for any typical oil sands project with companies, and 47% of profits get transferred to the federal and the provincial government through royalties as well as taxes. And we'll be exploring, okay, what could we have if we were to change the royalty regime that feeds into that? How could it be reformed so that we leave normal profits with companies and then get a better take for citizens? That might be 75%, it might be 85%. We'll be running different scenarios to see what that would mean in terms of increased revenue for Albertans. At the end of the day, we'll be trying to address the question, what is a fair commission for companies for developing our resource? And how can we design the regime then to make sure that they receive their fair commission and Albertans get the balance of the value of that resource. So just to finish off then, come back to the Pembina Institute's vision for oil sands development as it relates to the royalties, and that is that the development of the oil sands occurs at a pace and scale that optimizes the financial benefit to the owners of this resource. And what this means is a fair royalty regime that ensures Albertans receive sufficient value for the development of their oil sands resource.
Thank you, Amy. There's some chairs up here, by the way, if there are people there not seated, and we'll look forward to lunch and look forward to some lively questions. Okay. My friends, I think we're ready to resume. I hope there's lots of good questions around. Before we get into response to Amy Taylor, let me tell you that next week the speaker is Diane Pascal, and she's speaking on forest management in the Old Man Headwater. So that's next week, forest management issues. So I forgot to say at the beginning, but we welcome the viewers from Shaw TV too, and glad they're part of this whole conversation. Anyway, Amy Taylor is back. I invite your questions. There's only one mic in the room, so find your way to the lectern here, and let's have at this issue.
My name is Van Christou. I'd like to start by thanking Amy for a very, very clear dissertation on a complex topic. Amy, what I'd like to ask is, with the present plan that Pembina Institute has and the government has for reviewing this thing, how long do you think it's going to take to come to a solution where anything will be done?
That's a tough one. I can tell you, in terms of the process that the provincial government has underway, the consultations wrap up in June. The expert panel is expected to make a recommendation in, I believe it's August, and that will go to government. And then, who knows, at that point, they could decide to do additional consultation. There could be, you know, I mean, I really can't guess at that point. They'll do with that recommendation what they choose. And, I mean, I think it would make sense at least to, if there are to be changes, and hopefully there will be, that they would be implemented by next year's budget. So that's kind of our thinking in terms of how we'd like to see the change implemented, but time will tell.
Hi, I'm Hal Schroeder. Let me reiterate the thanks. That was a fabulous presentation. I wonder whether you happen to be listening to The Current this morning.
I wasn't, but
you heard about it. From that, I have two main questions. One of the items of discussion there was the percentage of after royalty and after tax that leaves Canada. Do you know what that percentage is? That leaves Canada, or remains in Canada?
I know I don't. What I do know is that 50% of the oil and gas sector in Canada is internationally owned. So that might give you some indication, okay. But I don't know the specific in terms of the actual profit transfer. But in terms of ownership, 50% is outside of the country.
Okay, thank you. And the other question is about foreign ownership. To what extent is foreign ownership prevalent in Norway? We compare quite significantly with their situation. If assuming that it is less prevalent, how do they manage that without nationalizing the resources? So thank you for your answers.
Well, in fact, Norway has quite a state interest in all of the projects in that country. So it's quite different in that sense. There is part government ownership of every project that takes place in that country. And Norway, if you look back in terms of how their royalty and tax regime evolved, they decided very early to have more of a national sector and to get the most revenue that they could from the development of that resource from the get-go. So the policies that as a result ensued have been quite different than what we see here. Because of that, the type of company that operates there is also, although there are some similarities, it's also quite different. It is a tricky comparison. We were talking about this around our table. It's hard to compare the oil sands legitimately to anywhere because there aren't oil sands of any significant scale anywhere else. So the kinds of things that we try and look for are, I mean, the oil sands royalty is based on net revenue or profit, so we look at other regions that have at least that in common and try and make those comparisons, because at least then you're correcting for the differences in the costs, because the cost of developing the resource in Norway is very different than it is in Alberta. So we need to kind of take into account those differences in costs, and by focusing on the profit or the net revenue, we're able to do that more easily.
Dwayne Pendergast. Thanks very much, Amy. I've heard that royalties are not collected on natural gas that's used to produce the oil sands. Could you tell us if there's any truth to that?
What happens with natural gas is their companies actually pay market value for it. So it's considered an input to the production cycle, just like labor or material. And they pay for it just as they would. They pay the market value. So it's quite a fair system. It's an appropriate way to pay for that input to production, just as you would labor or any other physical input.
You're saying then that they do pay royalties?
They do, yeah.
My name is Rapid Robert, and if I could always have made a 25% margin in farming, as I see some other gentlemen here, which it was when I started farming, now that I'm 10% behind and dying on the old age pension. But what I'm really curious about is I just left Fort McMurray and see that huge pipeline that is heading for, I don't know where, they tell me Chicago, which is going to pump the natural product to the United States and refine it down there. Are your people looking at, I hope we're going to be able to hold the refineries here in Alberta, and I know we can't, but that's my question.
We are just starting to engage in the upgrading question. And it would certainly be our first choice to have that upgrading done in the province and to have the full benefits of the resource thus realized in the province, and as well as the employment benefits associated with that. We haven't done a whole lot on it, but our perspective would be that we want to get the greatest value out of that resource possible, and one of the ways to do that is make sure that we're upgrading it here in Canada and not south of the border.
Other questions?
Thank you very much. I'm Lorna Brown, and I have a question about what's going to happen after the oil sands have been depleted. There's an awful lot of pollution there now. We're really great at polluting. Has the Pembina Institute taken that into consideration with their long-term ideas? Because I am concerned about that.
The environmental implications of the oil sands are certainly worthy of concern. It's not my area of study. As an organization, we have done a lot of work on that. Our website, pembina.org, has a wealth of information on the oil sands and the environmental implications. If you look at oil sands fever, you'll get a really great overview of some of the implications. We work very hard on that issue, and we do look at the long-term implications. We're talking about a resource that's going to be around for a long time, and as an overarching objective, we want to see that we are getting the most value out of it that we can, and so that means not just maximizing the financial value, but minimizing the environmental implications as well, so that we can, at the end of the day, have a positive legacy as a result of this significant resource. So I'd encourage you to visit our website and look for the document Oil Sands Fever if you're interested in a really user-friendly, easy read on the environmental implications of the oil sands.
Hello, Amy. My name is Cody Sharp. I have a question for you regarding the royalty review process that's going on right now. You said that anybody can come in and make a written proposal or a written submission. I was just wondering, how much interest is there from industry in this process, and how much opposition is there to reevaluating the regulatory regime regarding royalties?
Industry will certainly be engaged in the review process. To date, the only hearings that have taken place have been in Grand Prairie, and there, I think there was about 11 presentations made in total. And most of those were from citizens, but industry was certainly there. I expect that once they get to Fort McMurray, Edmonton, and Calgary, that the ratio there will flip and that it will be much more industry-focused. So they're invited to participate just as anyone else. Our stakeholders get 10 minutes, individuals get 5 minutes, and then anyone can submit online. the in terms of the opposition to the review, I mean, it's certainly the case that we've been calling for this, a review for a number of years, and we've been hearing from industry that it isn't needed. But I think there also is a recognition that the reality has changed. The price of oil is simply much higher than it used to be, and so that warrants a review. So I think there's increasing buy-in from industry. What that means in terms of what happens at the end of the day in terms of changes to the royalties, we'll see. But they certainly recognize that this kind of review is a healthy process.
Gert Talbot, and I'm a freehold owner. And are you associated with the freeholders?
Not associated with them.
Do they have an input into your...
To the review?
Yeah.
Anyone can have an input to the review, so certainly freehold owners can.
You can do the mic.
I come by it from an uncle that came out from England and got homestead land in 1884. The train stopped at Calgary, and so on, a buckboard, four wheels and planks, the piano, and that went into a sod hut. And this comes down through the way, but he got his through the CPR, I guess, on his homestead, and they reserved the coal for the steam engines at that time, never realizing that they were changed in time. And now we can't, so that's called a split title. And so now Encana has come along and says, we can't have it because the methylene that they want to take out of there, it's never been drilled on. It's because the coal is in the way. And the BC has legislated it so that the coal is a hard black rock in its natural state, and the gas, whether it's methylene or the other, is SITU, is it original state, is it in Latin? Is in its original state, it's gas. And so therefore we should be able to, now BC has already legislated it, and Saskatchewan's doing it, and the freeholders are about 1,500 in this country, and especially from Edmonton south. You'd be surprised how many people down here. Balkan is another big area. I wanted to know, we went to the Supreme Court, and it cost something like $19,000, and they refused to hear it and put it back into Alberta. Now, it's tied up in this legislation about the Alberta boat. Less than a month ago, let Lescar and two or three others go ahead and mine, and all around our property is it's being mined. And I just wondered if this goes in with this review for with Pembina.
I don't think it would. It sounds outside the scope of the royalty system. It sounds more like an approval type thing, but I don't think it's part of the provincial government's scope around royalty review.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's in legation until June 15th.
Right.
So is that to do with this?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so we're asking people whether you have freehold or not to sign a petition that we could ask the province to go ahead and legislate. That's it's our request.
Thank you. Other questions?
My name is Mark Nelson. I'm interested in who the Pembina Institute is. What kind of political affiliation you have and how the people for the expert board were chosen.
Pembina Institute is, we're kind of a unique environmental organization. We do a fair bit of consulting work. We do advocacy work. We have an education team that is teachers that write curriculum. We have a group that does policy research. In terms of my role in the organization, I mostly do consulting for governments, provincial, federal, and then do research with foundation grants. So our money comes from both foundations, donors, and through our fee-for-service or consulting work. We are nonpartisan, so no political affiliation at all. And there was a third part to your question. How was the expert panel chosen? My understanding was that it was a hand-pick situation. So they basically had a list of potential folks that and they, you know, must have vetted it and discussed it and came up with their priorities and invited people to participate. There was no, you know, put a name forward or anything like that. It came from the top down. People were invited to participate on it.
We'll close if there are no more questions. But
My name is Georgie Harper. I want to know if there's any consideration of allocating X amount as a maximum for both the water and the gas to continue this huge expansion.
You're speaking of the revenues, a portion of the revenues for water and gas? That is not within the scope of the current royalty review. As an organization, we've been suggesting that that the government on a regular basis put a portion of resource revenues into a long-term fund like the Heritage Fund as it was originally set up to do. That ended a number of years ago, and then since then there's been a couple of just ad hoc chunks of money put into the Heritage Fund. What we'd like to see is a consistent portion of resource revenues put into a fund for the long term, and then that fund could be used to deal with some of the environmental water, whatnot, implications of the oil sands. But it could also be used to mitigate some of the boom and bust economic cycles that are associated with dependence on resource revenue, where when the price of the resource goes up, we've got a whole bunch of money coming in, and when it goes down, there's not as much money coming in. So if we had this fund, we could try and smooth out some of those cycles. And then thirdly, to use some of that revenue to transition to some sustainable energy projects and efficiency. So we're investing in the long term in terms of transitioning off a non-renewable resource to a renewable resource. So I know the province plans to do an investment review that may or may not be part of what they look at, but it is certainly something that we've been recommending.
Trevor Page. Amy, thanks for your presentation. The oil internationally, the oil and natural gas or energy issue is very volatile. Here in Alberta, we're sitting on a resource which is going to last for quite a long time. The extent to which the profits from that resource stay within the country is a question. But I wonder if you could comment. I recognize that you're an economist, and I'm looking for an economic argument on this. Is if you put the oil sands issues in Alberta in the international context, with the price doing what it's doing and resources running out, do you not think that, although this is not an economic answer you would give, the federal government can sort of just sit back and say this is not our concern? I mean, volatility all over the world stability in terms of the resource base within Alberta on the oil front. It doesn't make sense. And then we've got the moral issue on, well, we want to actually, during the review, come up with something which is fair for Albertans. Who's the arbitrator? So you have economic turmoil internationally on the energy sector, and a review which is probably going to be the strength of the bargaining power, of Albertans versus the government. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. I don't know if you could comment on that from the economic standpoint. Thanks.
Wow. I'm not really sure what the question was, but you mentioned the federal government, and really, I mean, this is a provincial resource. Our constitution places it within the hands of the provincial government in terms of managing the resource. The federal government's involvement is limited to involvement in the approval stage when companies get approvals. And then, obviously, in the context of greenhouse gas emissions, which are of international concern, and the oil sands are Canada's fastest-growing source of greenhouse gas emissions currently. So there's certainly a role for the federal government to play in the context of the approvals and greenhouse gas emissions and climate change. After that, it really is the provincial government's domain in terms of managing this resource for Albertans. And we rely on our government to do that. And so we have to demand of our government that they do a good job. And one of the ways that we can do that is to get engaged in this review process and put our thoughts and recommendations out there and you know, demand that the government at the end of the day listen to us as citizens. It's our resource, and they're giving us an opportunity to have a voice, and it's important that we get engaged in that. I don't think so.
But I'll come back at the same time.
Okay. And we can talk after.
Art Sanford, Amy, excellent presentation. Very well, and enjoyed watching it. But let me ask you a tough question now. One of the most serious problems in the oil sands today is the amount of natural gas they're using, and that is a serious problem. And they're using horrendous amounts of gas as the energy for the oil because they need the heat. Now, all across Europe, what is commonly used for energy in a very big way, France, I think, is over 73% now, is nuclear energy. Mm-hmm. Right across the border from Alberta in Saskatchewan is the largest reserve of uranium in all the world. Tremendous amount, and the prices are way up. Would the Pembina Institute take a serious look and be in support of getting into nuclear energy in Alberta?
Yep, we are actually just about to take a serious look at nuclear energy. We are unlikely to support it because of concerns related to cost and environmental legacy, but we are taking a serious look at it. At this point, we're not hearing from any company operating in the oil sands that they are interested in nuclear. We've asked that question of numerous companies. We're not hearing that. We know of one company that is pushing it and a proponent of it, but at this point we don't actually think it's quite a very serious supply alternative. We would certainly support deep geothermal, which is also a possibility for the oil sands, but it is something that we're starting to look at because it is something that's being talked about more and more, especially as a result of one individual pushing for it. In fact, tomorrow we'll have a Pembina Institute person on a panel along with Ralph Klein and this fellow who's pushing his company, Energy Alberta it's called, which is nuclear focused. So, but as I said, unlikely for us to support it, but certainly something that we'll look at.
Howard Forsyth, since I got in late, you may have answered this, but I'm very curious as to whether you're feeling that the, is that too close?
Yeah, that's better.
You're feeling that you can work with Stelmach's provincial government better than you worked with Klein's. A lot of us are watching Stelmach to see what changes there are. Do you get any feel for that, or did you treat that?
I did not speak to that. We're certainly, I mean, we continue to look for opportunities to work with all governments. You know, the reason that we're engaged right now is because a royalty review is taking place. That's not because of a particular party that's doing it or not. It's because there's an opportunity there for us to get engaged and to put our recommendations forward and hope that at the end of the day they influence change. And so that's why we're involved, is because an opportunity was there. In fact, during the race in which Stelmach became the premier, all of the potential leaders supported, at least to some degree, a review of the royalty. So this was recognized as something that was going to take place before Stelmach came into power.
So you're sort of confident you can work with them, is that it?
We're hopeful that we can work with them. Confident would probably be a bit bold.
He's in town tonight.
Maybe he'll be watching TV.
Just don't get too close to the mic.
About here?
Yep.
Walter Mitzen. I'm wondering, last information I heard was that there's 4 or 5 barrels of water being used out of the Athabasca River to get a barrel of oil. Now, this is what happens to that water afterwards. I understand we now have a lake equal to a third of the size of Lake Erie that is poisonous and toxic. As I understand it, nobody's spending any money trying to clean it up. If a bird happens to be unfortunate enough to land on this lake, it is dead. Now, is there any money being spent on cleaning up this polluted lake, and who should be spending it? As I see the picture, our oil is being sold internationally for a good profit. We are stuck with the local pollution, and we may be stuck with having to clean it up if it will ever be cleaned up. Can you comment on it?
Yeah, 3 to 5 barrels of water for a barrel of oil is the ratio. And again, oil sands fever. Check it out on our website. There's a lot of information there. It touches a lot on the water. It's not something I'm hugely familiar with, but I know that you're right. There is quite a legacy being left there, and that we're incurring there in terms of the tailings ponds. It's a question mark in a lot of cases around what to actually do with the tailings, given the toxicity. It's pretty uncharted territory. It's quite a large-scale experiment that's taking place in the oil sands. Companies are certainly motivated to reduce their water consumption because it actually costs, they don't pay a lot for the water itself, but it does cost them a lot to process it, to move it, to heat it, and whatnot. So they are looking, and there have been gains in terms of being more efficient with their water consumption. But in terms of who pays for that legacy and that the pollution that's associated with it, well, we're certainly hoping that the companies will be on the hook for that and not us as citizens because, I mean, at the end of the day, we want them to be incurring the full costs associated with the development that's taking place, which means that they pay for not only the labor and the materials and the inputs, but they also pay for the outputs, whether that's in emissions or tailings, and we want to take those costs that are to a large extent external right now and build them in so that they become part of the cost of doing business. So there's a huge incentive there then to reduce those impacts. So that's essentially the polluter pay principle, and that's where we'd like to get to. We're certainly not there right now. At this point, a lot of those costs are outside their bottom line, and we need to get them in there in order to motivate them to minimize them and clean up the legacy.
Amy, can I ask a supplementary to that around the 3 to 5 barrels of water per barrel of oil? Mm-hmm. Is that fresh new water, or because I've heard somebody say that much of that water is recycled and it's not really new water. So
yeah.
Can you comment?
Again, I'm not sure if you know. I think I've heard that 90% of the water is recycled when it comes to in situ. In situ is the process of using pipes. In the cases where the oil sand resource is too deep to open pit mine, they use a process called in situ, which is putting pipes down into the reserve, and they pump in hot steam, and that steam moves up and then separates the oil from the sand, and then they can snag the oil. So it's this process that takes all the natural gas input and is a heavy use of water. But I think in the in-situ, they're recycling quite a high degree of it. I've heard 90%.
I've looked for that big lake up there with Google Earth, Amy, and I could find no sign of it. So I think maybe it's a little bit like the rumor of the no royalties paid on the natural gas. Do you think it would be possible to see that lake from Google Earth?
Well, I've been told by others that you can see it on Google Earth, so I'm not sure. I haven't checked for it myself. Maybe I'm not sure if someone else has, but I don't think it's one lake in particular. Is the other piece is it's several lakes, different tailings right. ponds.
There are some tiny bodies of water up there, but they're very small right. compared with Lake Erie.
Okay, I'll have to check it out on Google Earth. I'm not sure.
Amy, I wanted to try and put my earlier question into sharper focus. We were all affected by the price of gas internationally. And for a long time, and up until this time, OPEC plays a central role in fixing prices. We're sitting on the world's second largest oil resource here in Alberta. Is this not really more than just an Alberta issue? Can the central government, the federal government, afford not to get involved? I mean, the whole thing seems desperately out of proportion, and although it's great that Pembina is doing what it's doing in terms of reviewing the issue and coming up with some options,